WFAE streaming is sponsored by Corporate Information Technologies, a local IT company assisting business and taking a proactive approach to technology. CIT, let us show you how good IT can be. corp-infotech.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins, live from WFAE's DNC headquarters at Spirit Square. One of the cool things about a big political convention in town is you never know who you're going to see. Take yesterday morning, for example. One of our reporters was walking down Tryon Street at 8 a.m. and heard a familiar voice.
The cello comes in on this verse. Just keep your forehead together now. Oh, Valdemar. Pretty soon I'll be knocking on your front.
James Taylor, of course, conducting a sound check for yesterday's DNC-related Carolina Fest, and it seems those lyrics about storm clouds proved prophetic for his performance later that afternoon. Convention organizers say about 30,000 people attended the street festival. Whatever the turnout, the crowd quickly dispersed when evening storms came and rained it out. There was other action in the streets.
We are the Union!
Mighty, mighty Union!
Mighty, mighty Union!
Several blocks away, the annual Charlotte Labor Day Parade took place. About 300 participated, many here because of the DNC. They later had an organizing rally at Wedgwood Baptist Church. Here's Jeribu Hill of the Mississippi Workers' Center for Human Rights.
This meeting is historic in that it's bringing together workers in the South, union workers and non-union workers, immigrant workers, coming together in solidarity.
We'll have a report on that meeting, and we'll also discuss another movement, the effort to inspire young voters. We checked in on the DNC's Youth Council.
The youth vote is one of the most important votes for us this election cycle. This is in your hands.
We'll look into which issues are motivating young voters at this convention, which has more delegates under 35 than any Democratic convention in history. But first, we are joined by someone who helped organize this convention, Charlotte Mayor Anthony Fox. This is your big day. We had the party on Saturday for the media. Sunday was the very peaceful protest march, and yesterday was the big street party, Carolina Fest. Well, now, here we are on opening day. Are we ready?
It's been a good week. I think we've shown that we're ready, and it's going to be a great couple of days here.
How would you describe the process of getting ready? Now, raise the curtain on all that. How was the sausage made?
Well, I'm a big believer in studying for the test, and so we spent a lot of time doing due diligence, talking to people in Boston, in Minneapolis, in Denver, in all over the country where they've hosted conventions, both RNCs and DNCs before, speaking to their police departments, their transportation officials, their chambers of commerce, and so forth. And I feel like we learned an awful lot in that process, and we're applying those lessons here. Now, of course, you can predict and anticipate maybe 80% of what happens, and there's still that 20%, and we're trying to remain flexible and to be nimble as we go through the rest of the week.
Now, for those who have not been downtown, because they're staying away out of just one, not one.
But you know how much fun it is down here, Michael.
Well, it is. But it kind of looks like a fortress. Did you envision it looking like this as you went to all those planning sessions?
Well, you know, if you've spent time in Washington or you've been to an inauguration or something like that, when you've got this level of folks that need to be protected, you come to expect this type of thing. It's kind of different seeing it on Charlotte, but at the same time, all of our residents know how important this event is for us long term, and I've heard lots of people saying this is a great thing for Charlotte.
I know that you spoke to Tampa Mayor Bob Buckhorn, a fellow Democrat, about preparations in Tampa for the RNC, and as the convention unfolded in that city and after it got underway, did he have any words of advice after it got underway? Any revelations that have are going to be helpful here?
Well, the main one was roll with the punches. You know, we're going through this together. We went and got the security grant funding together, and we are definitely comparing notes in terms of what they experienced there. But, you know, you can anticipate only so much, and part of what you have to do in a situation like this is just roll with what happens.
And, of course, he's a Democratic mayor who was host of the Republican convention, and although I'm sure he wanted that convention to go off smoothly, you have a lot more pressure on you because you're a Democratic mayor hosting the Democratic convention. What kind of weight does that put on your shoulders?
Well, you just, you know, I think as a mayor, you really want people to have a good time either way. But in this case, I have lots of people that I've been working very, very closely with over the last year and a half to put this convention on, and I want them to be happy and proud that they picked Charlotte.
You're being modest because Politico came out on Monday with an article about all of these Democratic leaders around the country, and they say if you want to find the next generation of Democratic leaders, look to City Hall. And you are characterized in this article as being not only the mayor of the host city, but your party's most promising star in North Carolina.
Where's the question?
There's no question. I'm just asking for your reaction to that.
Look, I'm really pleased that we're hosting this convention. I think it's going to be great for the city and the state. And I do think that in a very general way that mayors across the country have something unique to say to the country right now, which is that we're in the no excuses level of government. You know, if a pothole shows up or the garbage doesn't get picked up, we get the phone call and we have to answer that question. And this country needs people who are practical, who understand that solutions don't have a partisan bent. And I think that's why you're seeing mayors being more prominently focused on the Democratic convention, because we know how hard the president's been working for cities and for urban communities, and we can talk about it.
Democrats tend to believe in government, if you believe the characterizations of the other side, while Republicans believe in as little government as humanly possible. Is this where the rubber meets the road, or is this a chance for you to show people who may be on the fence about whether they believe or not in government that cities can be an example of how to run a government?
I definitely think cities can be examples of how to run government, because we don't have the ability to spend money we don't have. And so we always have to balance things. And even when it hurts, we have to find ourselves doing that. I think that some of what's happening right now nationally is a reset button that's getting pushed on partisan politics. And I think Republicans are being called to the carpet on this idea that they're less government. They talk about less government, but if you look at bailouts and lots of other things that they've been supportive of over the last 10 years, two huge wars in Iraq and Afghanistan that cost us a lot of money. And frankly, even the tax reduction strategies they try to use create deficit spending. So we've got a long way to go as a country in terms of framing the debate in substantive real terms. But I think the president and the Democrats are doing a better job of that right now.
You told CBS News that the arrival of the DNC is a turning point for the city. How so?
This city has come such a long way. I'm 41 years old, grew up here, and remember before basketball, before football, that we were an aspirational city. And in many ways, this convention has been the culmination of those aspirations in terms of our ability to host an event of this size and this magnitude, and for the country and the world to see this city up close and personal over the next 4 days. So I feel very strongly that this sets a new floor for the city long term. You know, I don't know what comes next. Maybe it's a Super Bowl. Maybe it's an Olympics. But we can start thinking about it in those terms now, and I think that's awesome.
Well, we started seeing signs pop up around the city last week or the week before last saying, "We make it possible." Is that a new slogan for the city, or is that just a temporary slogan while conventioneers are here from elsewhere?
I want it to be a slogan for the city because I think it's authentic. This city has really been able to come out of almost nowhere to be what it is. We don't have a river running through us. We don't have some of the natural strengths that some cities do that have become large urban places. But we've basically been a bootstrap city. And we make it possible. It's all about saying that we make our own luck here. We do the work, we study for the test, and we pass the grade with flying colors because this city always does that.
You are speaking at the convention. What are you talking about?
I want to focus on the city's heart and soul. You know, so many people who know about Charlotte talk about it's a great place to do business, it's low cost, it's a good place to raise a family, good quality of life, and all of those things are true. But we almost never talk about the thing that I think is the most important thing, which is that the character of this community is one of confronting our challenges, seizing on opportunities, and moving forward. And I'm going to talk about my own experience in that as a young person growing up here through the school system at a very difficult time. People came together to make the schools work, and we were actually an example to the rest of the country. And I want people to know what a great city this is.
You told Bloomberg Television over the weekend that you expect the president to carry North Carolina again this election cycle. It appears to be painfully tight at the moment. So why are you optimistic?
Well, it was painfully tight in 2008, the president won, first Democrat to do so in 32 years. But more than that, I think this choice that people are going to be confronted with in November is such a stark choice. It's a choice between going forward and going backward. And I think North Carolina, our history has always been moving forward, and I believe we're going to do that again this year.
You pointed out that Mitt Romney didn't give out very many specifics in his speech at the convention in Tampa. Must the president be more specific? Must he share specifics for economic recovery?
I think in a sense, yes, and in a sense, no. I think that where the president needs to be specific is talking about the things that he has accomplished, because I think that those have been misconstrued based on some of the folks on the other side who basically don't want him to be successful. On the other hand, I think it's always the job of someone running for president to be aspirational and to point a direction out and to call us up as a country to move forward. And I think going forward, the president has the job of giving us the inspirational aspects of wanting to go out and vote for him again.
When this is all over on Thursday night, would you be relieved or will you be let down?
I will be hopefully really excited that this city did everything I thought it could do. I'll be very pleased with all of the collaborations that have made this entire event possible. So many people, from the Center City Partners to the city staff, the chamber, the regional partnership. I mean, we've just pulled together to make this event happen in a way that we've never had to do before. And I'm immensely proud of the city now, but I hope to be even more proud on Thursday.
Well, good luck tonight. I know you got to be nervous. I'd be a wreck.
It's okay. I've said a few words before. Thanks.
Charlotte Mayor Anthony Fox. Prior to Hillary Clinton, the last Secretary of State in a Democratic administration was Madeleine Albright, who, when she took office, became the highest-ranking woman in the history of the U.S. government. Secretary Albright has been in Charlotte several times in the last few months. Her collection of decorative pins is on display at the Mint Museum, and she joined us a month or so ago to talk about that. Well, now she's in Charlotte for the DNC. We met with her at her hotel yesterday and asked if she is here in an official capacity or simply because she's a Democrat working for the reelection of the president.
Kind of both, frankly. I am here because I'm chairman of the board of the National Democratic Institute, which works with foreign diplomats and foreign leaders to promote democracy, something we've been doing since 1984. And the first time that we had a program at a convention was in San Francisco. That I don't know whether people realize how many foreign visitors come to our conventions. And so we decided to, since 1984, to run parallel seminars for the foreign visitors so that they can really observe and understand what we're doing, how our democracy works.
Well, we're one of the few countries in the world, if I'm correct about this, with a presidential system. So what are they to make of this? What kinds of questions do they ask about what they see at these conventions?
Well, they ask, first of all, about how priorities are set, how are the party platforms written, How does it relate to what our media, what is the role of the press? What do you do generally in terms of systems of how the executive and legislative branches work together? That is similar, whether you're presidential or parliamentary, in a way that that operates. But I think they're fascinated by the openness of our system, of how it's not just a party for a party, but basically a way to see democracy in action.
We're also one of the few countries, I think, that has only two political parties, two official parties. What are they to make of that? Do they find that difficult to understand?
Some of them do, because one of the things that we've learned as we've operated abroad, some countries have, they begin with like 55 parties or something and then begin to narrow it down. But they are interested in terms of how a two-party system operates, what happens when there are demonstrations, and so they're here for the full experience.
Now, Hillary Clinton, I don't believe, is going to be at this convention. Is that because secretaries of state do not become involved in domestic politics, or is there another reason for that?
No, normally the secretaries of state do not get involved, and other high-level government officials do not get involved in party politics.
I know you know her well. This must be killing her to stay away from a convention.
Well, I don't know. She's on a great trip dealing with what I think is one of the outstanding problems out there now, which is what is going to happen with the South China Sea. In terms of how it is treated by the Chinese and our friends, the Filipinos and the Vietnamese, and navigation, freedom of navigation, maritime roles. And so that she's out there and she's going to be in Beijing. So I think she's been to a lot of conventions and will continue to go to them.
I want to remind people that you were Secretary of State under President Clinton, and there have been just a few Secretaries of State since your term of office. Condoleezza Rice was one of them, and she was one of the main speakers at last week's Republican National Convention. She and their nominee, Mitt Romney, were both critical of America's foreign policy under President Obama. They characterized it as being uncertain, of sending mixed messages to the rest of the world, and one of the RNC speakers, I don't think it was either one of them, accused the president of apologizing for American behavior all over the world. What would you say about our foreign policy these last 3.5 years?
I think our foreign policy has been very determined and smart under President Obama. First of all, I have to say that Secretary Rice and the Bush administration left a pretty hard hand to play for the president. I don't think I have ever seen a foreign policy that was in such disarray at the end of the Bush administration, leaving us with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which, by the way, they didn't mention in their speeches. And I think what President Obama has done is put America back in a position where we are respected, where people around the world understand that the role of the United States is not to dominate, but to be a partner in dealing with what are issues that require cooperation. Issues of how to deal with nuclear proliferation, how to deal with fighting terrorism, how to really work on issues of energy, environment, growing gap between the rich and the poor, and restoring the good name of democracy. So, and dealing with a global financial problem. And just mentioning those makes it very clear that the United States cannot and should not be operating alone. And so I think that President Obama and Secretary Clinton have really taken a measure of how the United States can and should be engaged, and that we are respected in a way that we were not 4 years ago.
You mentioned the disarray that you see our foreign policy having been left in when they left office. But Secretary Rice mentioned the situation today in the Middle East, specifically Syria and Iran. And let me quote what she said. She said, "Dictators in Iran and Syria butcher their people and they are a threat to regional security. Russia and China prevent a response, and everyone asks, where does America stand? Indeed, that is the question of the hour. Where does America stand? You see, when the friends or foes alike don't know the answer to that question, unambiguously and clearly, the world is likely to be a more dangerous and chaotic place." That sounds a little saber-rattling to me. Do we know where America stands, in your opinion?
I think we do know. I think we know that America stands behind those who want to have peaceful change in their governments. We stand for not operating with dictators. And we, in fact, I think, really work very hard with many countries in order to find common solutions. And that, for instance, what the United States did in concert with others was to make sure that the Libyan revolution really succeeded. I think we are operating with other countries in terms of the sanctions regimes on Iran and Syria, and that we make very clear that America stands with other countries and is not out there determined just to impose our will.
Do sanctions work? Because we hear that when America or any other country imposes sanctions on another country, the leaders don't suffer, only the people suffer, and it's only the leaders who can make changes. So do they work?
Well, I tell you what's interesting. I mean, I teach about this, and when we were in office, that was kind of seen as the decade of sanctions. We were trying to figure out what tools really worked in Iraq, in the Balkans. And what we did learn is exactly what you're talking about, is that one had to have what we now call smart sanctions that are focused on the leaders, that are on their cronies, that basically isolate them and make sure that they can't travel and do a lot of financial dealings, and that ultimately it is against the leadership and not the people. The other thing that I think people have not understood fully is even when there are complete sanctions on a country, food and medicine is not a part of it, the humanitarian aspects. And I do think that what is happening in Iran is that, for instance, the people there are seeing that there's energy issues to do with the sanctions there. They're very clear that it is the government that is making this happen, not the international community. So I think that it's a very useful tool. And for me, I believe that no one should ever take any option off the table. I teach a course on the National Security Toolbox. There are not a lot of tools in there, frankly. We're the most powerful country in the world, and yet the tools are diplomacy, the economic tools, which are the sanctions or the carrots, trade and aid, or the threat of the use of force or use of force. And so we can't take any option off the table, but I think the sanctions tool is one that mobilizes the international community.
You know, on the one hand, we cannot be the world's policeman. We can't go into every single country where there's conflict and intervene. It would be wrong of us to do that. But then Americans watch television at night and they see what's going on in Syria, and it's very troubling and it's very puzzling, I suppose, why, if we got involved in Iraq and in Afghanistan, why not Syria? We got involved on a limited basis with Libya. Why not Syria? How are those decisions made at the White House and State Department level?
Well, first of all, I think what is really important for people to understand is that not every situation is the same, that you try to do what is the most useful and where you can get something done. I made this up. I call it the doability doctrine. If you can actually accomplish something, then that's the tool that you choose. And Libya was for a number of reasons, different. I mean, Gaddafi did not have the kind of defense system that the Syrians have. It was also a country that was not as sectarianly divided as Syria, in a different location. So what you have the commander-in-chief for is to have somebody who understands the situation enough not to say, we did that here, now we do exactly the same thing somewhere else. The other thing that I think we have to recognize, and this goes back to the question you asked me about Secretary Rice and the Bush administration, Americans are tired, really tired, after Afghanistan and Iraq. And I believe that the Bush administration, I supported them on Afghanistan, but they took their eye off the ball in order to go into Iraq, which was a war that was really a war of choice. And the Americans are now, I think if you go out and talk to people, which you do and I do, I think people are genuinely tired.
And Afghanistan has become the longest war in our history, and although we know the end is in sight because there's a date certain that the president has put on it for withdrawal of troops, we wonder what we have accomplished there, and now we have these Afghan soldiers that we are training turning on our soldiers, the very people who are training them. And it makes you wonder, what, if anything, did we accomplish? When we leave, will that country be better off?
Well, I think it will be better off, but I think that our expectations can't be that it will be this perfect place. It's going to be a place, it's a process. It's going to be a long process. And President Obama has said our troops are coming out, but we are not going to abandon Afghanistan. There are going to be a variety of civilian activities, and private citizens will be involved in numbers of different ways. We're not totally going to leave it. I do think that the stories in the last couple of days about the attacks that have gone on have caused the NATO forces to suspend for the time being some training of the Afghan forces because they want to assess where it's coming from. I don't think it's ubiquitous. I mean, I think there are certain examples of this. But the Afghan story is a very sad and long story and a result, I think, of the unintended consequences of some foreign policy decisions.
Mitt Romney had some fairly tough things to say about China and about Putin, Vladimir Putin in Russia during his acceptance speech last week at the Republican National Convention. It almost sounded like a Cold War speech. Is that the right approach?
I think it's definitely not. We need to look forward to different relationships, both with Russia and China, and for that kind of a speech where, I mean, I do not agree with a lot of things that President Putin is doing, and he is having serious problems within his own country in terms of dissent, and I definitely don't approve of their stand on Syria and Iran, but I really do not think that it is useful at all to have a hectoring kind of approach to it, and also to say that they're our number one geopolitical problem. They are not.
What does the president have to say when he makes his speech, his acceptance speech, to both regalvanize his base and to capture the imaginations and enthusiasm of people out there for whom enthusiasm either may have waned or perhaps they never had it in the first place, but they're trying to make a decision? What does he have to say?
I think he's going to outline what his plans are for the next 4 years and also being very realistic about all the things that he had to do and the accomplishments that have taken place in the last 4 years. And I think his speeches in the last couple of days, I mean, I'm from Colorado, so I was very interested in what he was saying out there and talking about the importance of the middle class. I think that, I'm not a born American. I came here in 1949, lived in Colorado in the 50s, and I remember that my parents said the strength of this country was the existence of a middle class. And that is the class that is under the greatest threat at the moment. And so what I think President Obama has to really, and will, I think, talk about how much we owe the middle class, how they are the strength of America, and how they will prosper in a term of a president who really knows what he's doing, who isn't just making, I have to say, I'm obviously a card-carrying Democrat, but I was not impressed with Governor Romney's outlining of what he was going to do. And I think that President Obama has a plan about what he's going to do.
Former Secretary of State in the Clinton administration, Madeleine Albright, here in Charlotte for the DNC. We spoke to her yesterday afternoon. An outspoken advocate for women in the workplace, she told the Huffington Post yesterday that she thinks there are some who believe they are actually protecting women and that it is better for women to be taken care of. She says she thinks women want to take care of themselves and, frankly, doesn't understand why any woman would want to vote for Mitt Romney, except maybe Mrs. Romney. Coming up, we hear about celebrity surrogates, whatever they are, have more on yesterday's Labor Day parade, and hear from some young Democratic voices when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE from our DNC headquarters in Spirit Square.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Signature Healthcare, a concierge medical practice serving the Charlotte region since 2003, providing patients with 24/7 physician access, individualized attention, and same-day appointments. SignatureHealthcare.org. Coming up in just a few minutes on Charlotte Talks, a look at yesterday's Labor Day events in Charlotte, a preview of today's convention-related activities, and more. Stay tuned to Charlotte Talks here on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. One of the subsets of Democrats at this convention is the Democratic Youth Council. Young people helped push the then-candidate Obama over the top in 2008. This year's convention has more delegates under 35 than any Democratic convention in history. And WFAE's Michael Tomczyk spent some time with him yesterday. He joins us now. Good morning.
Hey, Mike. How are you?
I'm great. What is the function of, the purpose of the Democratic Youth Council?
I think you could kind of sum it up in one phrase that pretty much every single speaker that got on stage there said, and it's fired up and ready to go. I mean, essentially, their purpose was to kind of rally this voting block that in 2008 really overwhelmingly voted for Obama and turned out in near record numbers to do so. And I think some of the concern at the meeting yesterday, for example, the Democratic National Committee executive director got up on stage and said, you know, you guys were the heart and soul of the campaign in 2008. But frankly, there hasn't been that same sort of level of activity since. So it's kind of, can we get this voting block energized again and out there campaigning again?
How many people were there at that meeting, would you say?
I would say, I mean, it was a big ballroom convention hall. And I would say probably at least 100, I would say, more than that.
So when they hear from somebody with the party that you guys make a difference and can really make a difference, what was their reaction?
Most of the people I spoke to were really excited about that, Mike. I mean, that was something that they kind of take as a challenge. I mean, for example, I spoke with a master's student at the University of Oklahoma. Her name's Bailey Perkins, and here's what she had to say.
I know sometimes it gets a little daunting because you don't see a lot of young people talking about politics or being really engaged. And so the fact that we have people in our national leadership that are reaching out to us saying, you are critical, you are a part, and we need you here, kind of makes us want to step up to the plate.
So it galvanizes them a bit. That's what I guess is the point of having these caucus meetings.
Yeah.
What are the issues that turn these people on? What's important to them?
Well, and that was one of the things that stood out from the meeting to me as well, is that there was this substantial conversation about issues. And for example, one of the people there that I spoke with after the fact was a guy named Ted Geller Goad, and he's 28 years old. And he was there with his husband, who's a delegate from Chapel Hill. They were married in Massachusetts, but they live in North Carolina. And Ted told me that he was really excited to hear the issues discussed in the youth council. Here's what he had to say.
I think it was really interesting, not only that they kept hammering home the message about how the youth activism with getting people registered, getting them to polls is extremely important, but also highlighting these issues that are youth issues as well as issues towards other groups.
And what he went on to talk about were, you know, gay rights being a big one. Another one was women's rights and how many of the young people there think that the Democratic Party's platform is more in line with how they view women's rights and abortion rights than the Republican platform. And then honestly, the biggest applause line as the speakers were up there was about health care. Speaker after speaker got up there and talked about how there are millions of young people now who can stay on their parents' insurance longer because of President Obama's health care law. And that's, you know, something tangible that these young people could say, you know, this is something that actually has changed. Another point that also received some big applause lines was things to do with the DREAM Act, which of course was meant to allow young people who were born here to illegal immigrants to stay and work here. Of course, that didn't get passed, but President Obama did the executive order that allowed some young people who meet certain requirements to stay in this country and go to college or serve in the military.
And were the members of this youth council, are they delegates to the convention, or are they just did they just come to the convention?
Some were. I would say more people than not were just young people there, but there were delegates there as well.
Michael Tomczyk from WFAE News. Thanks.
Welcome.
Surrogates are everywhere this week. The media is constantly bombarded with requests to interview politicians, policy advisors, and in some cases, celebrities to speak in support of President Obama's reelection campaign. One of the most notable surrogates is actor Cal Penn. You may know him as the star of the Harold and Kumar marijuana comedy flicks or the TV shows House and How I Met Your Mother. Cal Penn took some time away from acting a few years ago to serve as Associate Director of the White House's Office of Public Engagement. Penn is no longer in that position, but he is the co-chair of President Obama's reelection campaign. It's in that role that he spoke to WFAE's Tanner Latham. He asked Penn about what's involved in preparing surrogates for duty and why should the public pay attention to them.
I've certainly learned a lot from the other surrogates, both both the artistic ones and the ones in politics. But yes, in terms of some of the other questions, there are policy briefings both for surrogates, for volunteers, for staff, which I think has been one of the most impressive things about both of the president's campaigns, is that it's built on this notion of wanting to, elevate the conversation, give folks information and the tools to have rational conversations with their neighbors. So, you turn on the TV and obviously you're going to see some pretty nuts back and forth on MSNBC or Fox or whatever it is. And that makes great television, but it's not really the reality of what a lot of working families are dealing with. And so when we're getting talking points, they're not just talking points. They're really policy proposals and talking about successes that the president's made. What are the compare and contrast between, Governor Romney's plan and the president's plan, things like that.
But do you still find that you have a challenge to overcome when you get into a public space like this? And you obviously have name and face recognition, but it's probably not going to be on a whole for your knowledge of politics or interest in the Obama campaign. People are probably going to say, oh, it's that guy from fill in the blank, be it, Harold and Kumar or from How I Met Your Mother. I mean, that's how people are probably going to engage you in that sphere. So then how do you quickly both parlay that recognition but also convince them that you know what you're talking about? I mean, why would they want to hear what you have to say on issues like that?
That was the exact question that I asked myself when I started as a surrogate for the president in 07 and 08. And we would, we would hold events on college campuses, for example, or in field offices in all these states. And the first couple of stops, I was really nervous because I thought, I of course really appreciate and love all the fans of our movies and TV shows, and they let me love to do what I love to do in life. My first love is always film and always acting. But I wanted to make sure that, they're not coming out for the wrong reasons. And I thought, I hope they're not coming out here expecting a comedy show or something like that. And from the very first stop in a high school in West Des Moines in Iowa, you had about 150 young people in this room, and I just made some small remarks about why I was volunteering for the president, and there were field staff that were doing pitches on policy and what the president was, or then senator, was standing for. And then we opened it up for a half hour of Q&A, and not one question in the entire half hour talked about movies or TV. All of these folks wanted to know, what was this senator going to do for their family that was serving in Iraq, or what was he going to do for the job market if these high school kids were going into college? What were they going to do for college affordability, for healthcare? I was really sort of floored. I don't know that at 17 I would have had the presence of mind to ask questions like this, but I was really inspired to see that, I know there for the right reasons and because I believed in this guy, but I wasn't sure what the tenor was like for young folks around the country. And to see that at every single stop, every now and then, maybe every 10 stops, you get one question about a movie. But I thought that was remarkable that young people from all political walks of life are there because they want to hear about what their future would be like under President Obama, or now under a second Obama term.
Do you have any political aspirations yourself? Has this taste given you any... No,
I do not. I've never worked in politics before. I remain deeply inspired by this president and fired up to serve him as best as possible, and then hopefully go back to making some more fun movies.
That is actor. I can't think of his name. We just did it. Cal Penn, excuse me, on Charlotte Talks. Fewer than 3% of North Carolina workers belong to a union, the lowest rate of any state in the nation. But a hearty contingent of about 300 came out for the annual Labor Day parade in Charlotte. Many of them also spent the holiday afternoon at an organizing meeting for low-wage workers. WFAE's Julie Rose reports.
Because of DNC security restrictions, some of the biggest crowd pleasers of the annual Charlotte Labor Day Parade didn't get to participate yesterday.
All the car clubs and all the bike groups, pedicabs, down to Razzles the Clown on his unicycle.
Charlotte Labor Day Parade organizer Ben Lee says basically nothing with wheels was allowed. The parade also didn't march through Trade and Tryon, as it typically does. It was confined instead to the route designated for protests during the DNC.
We are the union!
Still, a dedicated group of high school marching bands and union members participated on foot. United Auto Workers from the Freightliner plant in Mount Holly were one of the largest groups. Had it not been for the union, Tony Hawkins says things would have turned out much worse for him during mass layoffs at the plant in 2008.
It kept me my benefits while I was laid off. I had seniority rights to come back. You know, they had no choice but to bring me back when things picked up.
Some national labor groups criticized the Democratic Party for bringing its convention to a state with such low membership and laws that discourage organizing. Locally, union leaders were frustrated the DNC scheduled Carolina Fest on Labor Day in direct competition with the Charlotte Parade, which is the largest in the state. While unions remain key allies of the Democratic Party, the national AFL-CIO declined to support the convention this year in favor of spending money on its own grassroots strategy. North Carolina members of the Postal Workers Union marched in a DNC protest on Sunday, demanding the party do more for the working class.
If you know it, sing it! Which side are you on? I want to know now!
A similar sentiment carried over to Wedgwood Baptist Church yesterday afternoon, where Jeribu Hill rallied a sanctuary full of low-wage workers from across the South. She's with the Mississippi Workers Center for Human Rights, and that song wore out her voice.
This meeting is historic in that it's bringing together workers in the South, union workers and non-union workers, immigrant workers, coming together in solidarity.
Southern states rank among the least unionized in the nation, with North Carolina at the bottom, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Multiple workers' rights groups organized yesterday's meeting as a chance for laborers from the field to the meatpacking plant to the city sanitation system to share ideas about organizing for better pay and conditions. Leonard Walker came from Tar Heel, North Carolina, where he works at the Smithfield meatpacking plant. Just in the last few years have workers there managed to unionize, says Walker.
Yeah, well, we're 68% unionized out of 5,050 employees.
And what good does that do you?
Girl, whew. How can I say this? Before the union, you had people urinating on themselves.
He says workers felt so intimidated, they were afraid they'd be fired for taking a bathroom break.
Now that the union's in, now when you got to go to the bathroom, go.
Walker left yesterday's meeting with new ideas to help his fellow workers understand their rights.
We're dealing with that every day. And me learning what I know now and taking it back to the plant helped them get better educated.
In Charlotte, sanitation workers have picketed City Hall the last four Mondays, calling on council to adopt a municipal workers' bill of rights that would establish minimum working standards and a union-like negotiation over benefits. They hope the DNC's presence here will draw additional attention to their demands. For WFAE News, I'm Julie Rose in Charlotte.
Charlotte Talks producer Tim Ross went to the Unity 2012 event held to support the gay and lesbian community earlier this week. They are part of a whole group of people here who want to make sure that President Obama doesn't forget about them.
I'm from Charlotte, and I am here tonight mostly because it's called Unity Charlotte. And I see this as a unified community, a community that needs to move in that direction and is moving in that direction. And I see this presidential election as a very key moment, whether we're going to be unified or whether we're going to be divided.
A lot of the arguments are always about the Bible says or God says, and I can understand people's view on that, but no one's asking for a church to change matrimony or anything like that. It's all about, you know, two individuals and how they feel and basically the civil right aspect of it. So I've never really understood what the big deal is as far as the opposition. So I think it's interesting because what happened in Charlotte, North Carolina with the ban, and now the DNC is going to be here. So it's going to be interesting to see how the convention goes.
My name is Vinnie Brown. I'm from Hawaii. I'm part of the Hawaii delegation. And I'm here because I believe that civil rights and social justice are the backbone of the Democratic platform. I believe in GLT rights. I believe in social justice. And that's why I'm here. That's what brings me here today. I'm married to my husband happily for 11 years. And I just want to make sure that you know, we're able to enjoy that, and those rights are spread out across the nation, and that's, you know, that's pretty much what I'm about.
Are you in a position yet to reveal whether it will absolutely be announced that gay marriage will be part of the platform?
Well, we have to vote on the platform. I can't make a statement until the platform's voted on. There's a lot of delegates here. There's over 5,000 delegates here. Everybody gets their vote. I know how I'm voting on that. I'd like to see it officially become part of the platform, but the delegates have to vote on it. I can't speak for them, but I'm confident that they are going to support it, and I'm confident it's going to become part of the platform, and nothing would make me happier. That would make this trip all worthwhile.
Chrissy Chambers
and Bria Cam, and we are Bria and Chrissy.
You're a lesbian duo singing for
equality.
That's what we're here for.
We're actually from Atlanta, Georgia.
Yeah.
And we are here to support the convention and promote the LGBT community.
Well, the gavel will sound today, and the Democratic National Convention will begin. Much of what we see are the speeches, and each speaker has a job to do. We talk about that with Dr. Eric Heberling when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Gary McCoy, Amazing Carolina Homes, offering home buyers and sellers sales strategies with experience, technology, and market research. A Keller Williams realtor. Details at AmazingCarolinaHomes.com. Remember that you can stay tuned to WFAE throughout the day for convention-related news, and you can always find more information on our website. Just go to WFAE.org. You're listening to Charlotte Talks on Charlotte's NPR news source, 90.7 WFAE.
We're back in our DNC headquarters at Spirit Square here for Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins, Associate Professor of Political Science at UNC Charlotte. Dr. Eric Heberling is with us in this segment every day this week. And today we take a look at who will be speaking beginning tonight at the Democratic National Convention and what they will likely talk about, as well as how these speaking assignments are parceled out. Welcome back.
Morning, Mike.
One of the functions of these conventions, obviously, is to tell your story, to create a narrative that will engage other people, other voters. What is the story that the Democrats have to tell over the next 3 days?
They want to tell where we are and where we're going, and why the Democrats are the best positioned party to get us to where we as a country want to go. So you'll both hear discussions of what the accomplishments are. They think that are most important to people of the Democratic Party over the last 4 years, what accomplishments they're aiming for, should we reelect them, and how that contrasts with the vision that they're going to say the Republicans are offering us.
CNN ran a documentary last night that struck me as being fairly partisan in favor of the president's track record, so to speak, looking carefully at the stimulus package, at the automobile bailout, at some of the other things, including health care, and the benefits that health care has provided to a certain segment of the population already, and fundamentally said, and we're going to talk about this with a guest tomorrow, that the problem is that he has not done a good job of telling that story, and that's a story he can tell.
Certainly, you'll hear Democrats argue that it's a communications problem, but politicians typically fall back on it's a communications problem if the message isn't resonating. But I do think they will want to remind people of the accomplishments of the administration and make the case that no, things aren't where we'd like them to be. We'd understand why you'd be disappointed, but these are real concrete accomplishments that we're proud of.
Now, the Republicans sent some attack dogs to the podium throughout their convention last week and left the Mr. Nice Guy role to their nominee, Mitt Romney. Will the Democrats do the same thing?
I think so, particularly when the president of the United States is your candidate. The president must appear presidential. So you're going to have the other people who are speaking throughout the real red meat really try to rally the base, really attack the other side. You'll certainly have the president criticizing Romney and the Republicans, drawing contrast between them, but you'll have him do it in a way that's more civil.
Mayor Fox speaks tonight. He's been described along with other Democratic mayors as part of the next generation of Democratic leaders, and Fox has been called by Politico. He's been called the Democrats' most promising star in North Carolina. Does the host mayor always get a speaking spot at these conventions if they are of the same party?
Yeah, Well, they do. At the very least, as a way of welcoming the delegates to the convention city.
Is there a special significance to him being?
There is one role that the speakers play in the party conventions. One reason why they're selected is to highlight the up and coming players in the party. And it's clear that the Fox has thought of that way within the Democratic Party.
And some of the people speaking, as I'm told tonight and tomorrow night, are not necessarily even up and coming players. They're just average Joes who have a story to tell about how President Obama's policies have impacted them, correct?
Absolutely. And the Democrats are making a big deal out of these ordinary speakers because that brings a whole new level of credibility to these claims of policy accomplishments. It's one thing for the party to say we've done X, Y, and Z, but we know they're going to perhaps overemphasize, overly claim credit. When you have a real person saying, this is what that does for me, I think that resonates with ordinary people.
But if you're not a political junkie who watches the thing on C-SPAN, will you ever see these people?
You may. I mean, it gets picked up by local stations such as yours.
Okay. Obviously, just as the Republicans thrash the president's policies, Democrats need to go after the Republican plan under the Romney-Ryan ticket. What will they hit on? Who will they send to the podium to do that?
I think we're going to hear a lot about the war on women. The Democrats are sending a number of female speakers. Lilly Ledbetter, for one, who is one of the has a act of Congress named after her, an equal pay act. It was one of the first things passed when Obama became president. Elizabeth Warren, the Senate candidate for Massachusetts. So we'll hear a lot about that. We'll certainly hear.
Bill Clinton is speaking.
Yeah.
He's not always been in the president's corner, but now he seems to be, and a lot of Americans appreciate how the economy performed under President Clinton. Is that why he's here?
That's why he's here. He's the most popular Democratic politician. I think we'll also hear him take on the Republican lies, particularly the one about welfare. Bill Clinton signed the welfare reform in the 1990s, championed that, so there's no more credible person than him to say the Republicans are misrepresenting what Obama has done on welfare.
One of the bright and shining stars of the Republican convention at the speaker's platform was Mrs. Romney. Mrs. Obama speaks tonight in the 10 o'clock hour. Is her function the same as that of Ann Romney? What does she need to say or do?
Yeah, it's very similar. She's going to humanize President Obama. The president is kind of aloof, kind of academic in his image. She's going to warm us up to him, talk about the pressures of the presidency and how he as a person has dealt with that in a way that helps make us feel what it's like to govern under the difficult economic circumstances he's governed under.
And the keynote speech is being given by San Antonio Mayor Julian Castro. What kind of keynote is it likely to be?
Well, it's very interesting because I don't think many of us know very much about him. He's clearly being put forth as one of those future of the party speakers. He's a mayor.